Welcome again, everyone, to the New Books Network Native American Studies channel. This is Ryan Tripp, your host. We're here today with Professor Colin Calloway, 1943 Sean Kimball Professor of History, as well as Professor of Native American Studies at Dartmouth College. Welcome, Professor Calloway.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we're going to be discussing your newest book, The Indian World of George Washington, The First President, The First Americans, and The Birth of the Nation. So, and just dive right into the questions here. What prompted you to study the Indian world of George Washington, and why the focus on land?
Yes, I think for someone who's written and researched and taught about Native American history for forever, the question sometimes is, why do a book on a dead white guy? George Washington is perhaps the deadest white guy we can think of. And it is a conscious choice, and I think of it as a strategic book, because I wanted to use George Washington as a vehicle. In my teaching and my research and my writing, along with many other people, we've argued for years that Indian history is fundamental to understanding American history. It's not just about adding another chapter or adding having somebody else's voices heard, although that's important. It's also recognizing that American history would not have happened as it did, unfolded in the way that it did, in important places and at important junctures, without the presence and the power of Native Americans, particularly in the early history of the nation. And that's been an uphill struggle. So my thinking was that George Washington, perhaps the most famous American, certainly the most iconic figure in the creation of the nation, if I could show how Native Americans, their power, their presence, their land, shaped the life of the first president, that would demonstrate their role in shaping American history, particularly in that early and sort of embryonic stage. And the focus on land is essential, because I suppose the bottom line to understanding this approach or accepting this argument is that the United States is fundamentally a nation built on Indian land. In 1492, the continent was all indigenous land. Now it's not. And George, I'm not putting these words into George Washington's mouth. George Washington understood that. He understood that that Indian land, Western land, was the key to his own personal fortune, but that it was also the key to the growth and expansion of the nation, and in some ways, to the very survival of the nation. Before I started off on this project, I read a lot of biographies of George Washington, not all of them by any means, but one of the things that I noticed, particularly in a lot of the older biographies, very little mention of Indians. Mention of Indians when George Washington encountered them in the early years of the 7 years of French and Indian War. Mention of John Sullivan's expedition into Iroquois country during the American Revolution. Not much else. But lots of talk about land. And it struck me that every time land was mentioned, if you added Indian land before that, or substituted Indian land for Western land, huge part of Washington's life is all about that. And I think that's not a sort of revisionist view, I think, of American history, but rather an acknowledgement of a fundamental fact of how this nation came into being. Washington understood that, And I think we should understand that.
Your cover features a striking composite dual portrait of a young George Washington and Corn Planter. Can you comment further on both the cover and your reasons for selecting said cover?
Yeah, well, the cover is the design team at Oxford University Press, and I think they did a super job. It wasn't the first attempt. There were a couple of trials and errors that didn't quite work out, and at one point my daughter, who's an artist, got involved. But this is, I like the cover because one of the things that I felt was important was there are so many books on Washington and there are so many striking portraits of Washington, and this needed to compete. I've always thought of this had to be a book that was a substantial book that could muscle its way into this impressive and formidable literature on George Washington. And what I like about it is how they've taken that portrait of a young George Washington, as far as we know, it's the first portrait of him where he chose to be painted wearing his militia uniform from his time on the Ohio frontier in the French and Indian War. And as my daughter says, it looks like he's giving Corn Planter the side eye. Because I wanted this not to be a book, George Washington and American Indians, in which it's really about George Washington and his policies, but rather a reconstruction of a world that George Washington and other people at his time inhabited, which was a world with in many places, an omnipresent Indian presence. And Corn Planter is one of many Native leaders whom Washington meets and deals with. And so placing them together as the designers did, I think is appropriate. They should be equal players in this. Plus there's that just very nice blending of the deep reds in the portraits that helped to give it a little bit of impact.
It's a great cover. So for a more specific question, in 1748, George Washington's, and you write, journal of a trip to the Blue Ridge Mountains and beyond to the Shenandoah records his first experience roughing it on the frontier. He complained about the dirt and discomfort he had to endure and marks the beginning of a lifelong obsession with Western land. He also met his first wild Indians. And then you further contend that Washington ultimately conducted 45 surveys west of the Blue Ridge. How did this first trip west of the Blue Ridge and his early role as a surveyor ignite an obsession with Western land?
So Virginia, in the early part of the 18th century, for much of the 18th century, I suppose, is actually at the forefront of colonial expansion westward across the Blue Ridge Mountains and then across the Appalachian. And actually, if you look at a map of Virginia at that time and see the claims to western lands that Virginia had, you can understand this. And Virginia was looking to the Ohio country and beyond. And so in Virginian colonial society, surveying was an important and lucrative position. If you were not an elite landowner, acquiring huge tract of land, you can make a good living and acquire land yourself by working as a surveyor. So this, as a teenager, Washington gets his first taste of this. And yes, this is the first time he meets a group of so-called wild Indians. He talks about them doing a war dance and so on. He's not particularly interested in them, but what he is interested in is the land. And he learns the trade. He doesn't spend a huge amount of time doing it. He gets his first, acquires his first real estate, if you like, makes some money. But what he does is he learns how to look at land with a surveyor's eye, I think. And what he notes about the land in his subsequent travels reflects that. And also in his subsequent writings about land, particularly the land that he's trying to get or has acquired for himself. One of the terms that he uses repeatedly is the cream of the country. So he can be traveling through the Ohio country on the banks of the Ohio River, passing what he must have seen was Indian mounds created by earlier Native American civilizations. He doesn't really say anything much about those. What he notes is meadows, fertile land, riverfront land, because this is the land that he recognizes represents an investment on considerable future to come. Now, contemporaries and some of people who have talked about this have acknowledged that Washington was an accomplished speculator, even at a time when which is marked by land speculation. If Virginia is at the forefront of expanding onto Western land, George Washington's on the forefront of Virginia's expansion, he and people like John Walker. But what that reflects is not only Washington's preoccupation, if you like, obsession with getting land. This is business as usual in early America, because land is the key to wealth. Land is the key to progress, as they would see it. And for someone like Washington, land is the key to fortune and ultimately a rising status. And that, I think, is an important story of early America. It is a story that involves converting Native American homelands into American real estate. And the people who are involved in that, they're often networked together. Those are the people who position themselves to do well in that process.
You also argue that a Native American man in the early 1750s, Tana Grison, had encouraged Washington in the early 1750s to fight the French and had encouraged the Shawnees and Delawares to assist him. In the 1754 capitulation at Fort Necessity, it was a blow to Tana Grison's standing and to Iroquois authority over the Ohio Indians. For our listeners, can you briefly recount the events that culminated in this Battle of Fort Necessity, as well as a brief description of who this Native American man was, Tana Grison, as well as the immediate aftermath that ultimately precipitated the Seven Years' War?
Yes, in a lot of earlier biographies of George Washington, these events, and particularly the skirmish in which George Washington and a company of Virginia militia and a handful of Indians fight the French and defeat a contingent of Frenchmen led by Anselme de Jumonville, that is sometimes characterized as Washington displaying those remarkable talents of leadership that are going to mark him for greatness in subsequent years. And sort of cards on the table here is I've read through these documents and tried to reconstruct that sequence of events in my own mind to my own satisfaction. I fail to see that. I see Washington's talent for leadership elsewhere, other places, later, not there. I see a young man out of his depth and actually someone who's being manipulated by Tenarison. George Washington first met Tenarison on a diplomatic mission to the Ohio country for the governor of Virginia. he was sent to ask the French if they would kindly withdraw from the Ohio country because the French were actually advancing, installing garrisons, building forts, etc. The French refused, and Washington was then sent back with a force of colonial militia because the Virginians were trying to take control of the forks of the Ohio, which, of course, was the key to that area of the world and the continent. Tenarison was also called the Half-King, and that was a title or a position rather than a name. A Half-King was appointed by Onondaga, which was the central council fire of the League of the Six Nations. That's the Mohawks, Oneidas, Onondagas, Cayugas, Senecas, Tuscaroras, who, on the basis of earlier military activity in the previous century, claimed a influence, if not dominion, over the Ohio country, and appointed a Half-King almost as an ambassador, or in a British medieval context, perhaps a martial lord, to oversee and represent their interests in that country. The Half-King also, of course, had to serve as a conduit representing Ohio Indians in their relations with Onondaga. And as you can imagine, that was a position of some influence and power. But it was also a precarious position, and becoming increasingly precarious in this time period, because Shawnees and Delawares and other Ohio peoples were kind of flexing their muscles a little bit and saying, we're going to move away from this. We're going to cast off that Iroquois claims to dominance. We're going to, if you like, declare our independence. So that's undermining that position. And then, of course, when the French come, that threatens the intermediary role that Tenarison, the Half-King, can play between the French and the English, between the tribes and Onondaga. So when the French invade Ohio country, Tenarison goes to the French and gives them a good telling off and says, if you don't cease and desist, then I will come with Ohio Indians at my back and we will take care of you. And the French basically call his bluff. And it actually is bluff, because the Shawnees and the Delawares and the other Ohio Indians are not convinced that they want to expel the French, because they have their own problems with the British. And they are also the people who, if a shooting war begins, recognize that they will be stand to be caught in the crossfire. So the French didn't withdraw, and the Ohio Indians didn't rally around Tenarison. So at the very least, to save face, but also to kind of reassert his position, Tenarison, it's in Tenarison's interest to foment conflict between the English in the form of Virginia and the French. So as Washington is coming with his force, Tenarison keeps telling him, so the French are on the move, there's a French force out, and they're coming this way, they're heading to attack you. Washington and Tenarison team up, they go in search of the French, and they essentially seem to have ambushed the French at a place that's now called Jumonville Glen. Washington, in his accounts of that skirmish, glosses over it very quickly, which is not like Washington. Historians who've dug deeper into this and gotten other sources get a different picture. And that is that the Virginians opened fire on the French. The French seem to have been on a diplomatic mission, doing what Washington had tried to do earlier, that is asking the English to withdraw. And as the French break and run, they fall to Indian tomahawks. And Tenarison kills Jumonville quite brutally and graphically. And it's quite a grisly episode, and interested readers can follow up. And then immediately sends wampum belts and a hatchet out to say that we're at war with the French. I see Washington in that realizing that things have spiraled out of control, because the person counting the shots, calling the shots, is not George Washington. It's Tenarison. And Tenarison, I think, maneuvers Washington into this, what I think is a debacle. Washington is subsequently forced to retreat because a French army is coming to avenge this. And he builds this little palisade, not much more, at a place called Fort Necessity, where he's attacked by the French and their Indian allies. It's an untenable situation. He's forced to surrender. And when he surrenders, unwittingly, he says, he signs terms of surrender that acknowledge that he assassinated, murdered Jumonville. It's a huge propaganda tool for the French. And it has reverberations not only through America, but across the Atlantic, where British ministers say this was a disaster. And I think that's a good example of what I'm trying to do in this book, and what a lot of my colleagues in Native American history are trying to do. Here's a series of events that if you relate them or narrate them with no Indians present, it actually doesn't add up. But if you inject Native Americans back into the story and get, to the extent that you can, their versions of it or the French versions of it to complement and flesh out what we get in the English sources, you get a much fuller understanding. And I think that's kind of what I'm trying to do in this book, not show that Washington was a bad guy or a fool or any of those kinds of things. But as in so much of American history, there are points at which, if Indians are not in the narrative, then the narrative actually doesn't make much sense.
On that note, in the historiography, it is often said that the disaster at the Monongahela, which was during the Seven Years' War, convinced Americans in general, and Washington in particular, to break with conventional British tactics and employ their own American way of war. Washington subsequently trained his men in Indian ways of warfare. However, it took time to retrain and re-equip troops. And even as Washington came to recognize the effectiveness of the Indians' tactics, he despaired of being able to match them. Can you elaborate on this disaster, as well as the ensuing training and despair?
In the wake of the surrender at Fort Necessity, the British dispatched to North America the biggest army it has sent to kind of get the job done. Washington had failed. The British had to take control of the forks of the Ohio to stem the French advance. The army was led by General Edward Braddock, and the idea was that he would lead this army, blaze a trail across the Appalachians to forks of the Ohio, and it would be an irresistible force that would simply sweep the French aside. In the event, what it does is demonstrate the limits of empire in Indian country, because Braddock's army achieves a tremendous feat in building or hacking a road through the forests and mountains to reach virtually within grasping distance of Fort Duquesne at the forks of the Ohio. And it is then attacked. It's not really a planned ambush. It's almost more of a collision by a force of Native Americans and some French. French forts in the West depended for their defense not upon gunpowder and palisades, but upon the Indian allies that existed around the fort. Without Indian allies, the forts were indefensible. And when those two forces collide, the Indians go to fighting as they've been trained to do. They go to the trees. They lay down barrage of fire and render themselves essentially invisible to the British, who respond as they've been trained to stand in ranks and fire, which means, of course, that this battle rapidly becomes a one-sided event and literally a killing field in which the redcoats are mowed down and eventually, after about 3 hours of this, discipline unravels and the army retreats and it degenerates into a rout and General Braddock is killed. Washington, by all accounts, not just his own accounts, but by all accounts, demonstrates commendable courage. He's one of the few officers who's not wounded. He has bullets in his coat, horses shot under him, that kind of thing. But this is something that adds to his reputation, right? And perhaps really enhances his reputation. So up until this point, his record in Indian country is a shady encounter at Jumonville, a debacle at Fort Necessity, and a massive, or being present at a massive defeat. But the courage that he shows here is kind of elevates him. Now, according to the story that's often told, is that having seen the British redcoats, a conventional army, out of its depth, floundering and destroyed by Indians waging guerrilla warfare, Washington and other Americans learn that lesson and say later on, okay, so this is how we will defeat the British, and that they will then do that in the Revolution. Because in the Revolution, the mythology has embattled American farmers shooting from behind walls and trees and kind of robotic redcoats trying to fight in ranks. In reality, the British adopted their tactics during the French and Indian War, the Seven Years' War, developing far more light infantry, companies of rangers fighting guerrilla warfare, that kind of thing. And George Washington, in the Revolution, tried to emulate the British in creating a conventional army. In fighting the British, Washington recognized that he needed a British-style army. And what he complains about or points to in his accounts of Braddock's defeat is not so much the tactics that the British used, but the breakdown of discipline. And he continues in the Revolution to try and instill that kind of discipline in his fighting. It's a little different fighting Indians. And Washington, in the wake of Braddock's defeat, is tasked with defending the western frontier of Virginia with Virginia militia. He tries to organize and discipline these militia, but he also recognizes that they are totally inadequate for fighting Indians. That basically, he says, in order to fight Indians, what you need is Indians. You need Indian allies. So I guess what I'd put it in a nutshell, I'd say when it comes to the Revolution, Washington wants a conventional army to defeat a conventional army, but he will also, like the British, employ guerrilla tactics and guerrilla forces to supplement that conventional army. But then there's a different way of fighting Indians, and we can talk about more about that in a moment.
So during the Seven Years' War, you aver that Washington simultaneously, and this is a offshoot question, recognized and resented his dependence on Indian allies. Unable to give them what they had been promised, he feared losing them altogether. Can you elucidate the consequences of this dual recognition and resentment?
Yes. So every American war, every so-called Indian war, has Indians fighting on both sides, because Indian people did not respond as a race to white invasion. They responded as individual nations with their own foreign policies. So in this war, Washington and his Virginian troops on the frontier are confronting Shawnee and Delaware raids from the Ohio country. and they're unable to handle it. And what Virginia does and what the British do is solicit the assistance of Indian allies from the south, particularly Cherokees. And those Cherokees come north to help the Virginians, help Britain in fighting the Shawnees and Delawares. These are not racial traders. They're doing what makes sense to them. And they have often their own antagonisms with Northern Indians. Washington knows that he needs them, but it's also an exercise in frustration and on both sides. Washington complains that the Indians are mercenary. They won't do what he wants them to do. You have to keep giving them gifts. At the same time, he sees no irony in the fact that he's complaining to the governor of Virginia that he and his men, and him, he in particular, are not paid enough for their services, right? But Indian people have come north under contract, in a sense, that they've been asked by the British to send their warriors to fight alongside the British, and in return, they expect that their women and children will be looked after when they're away, and that they will receive the supplies that they need, food, guns, ammunition, etc. They're often just called gifts. And giving gifts in Native American diplomacy is fundamental. It's not payment. It's not just payment. They're not mercenary. Giving and receiving gifts cements an alliance. Giving gifts shows that you are committed to this alliance. Receiving gifts helps establish an obligation. So giving and receiving gifts is something that allies do. Penny-pinching British administrators or people who regard this as just payment are going to undermine that relationship. So the Cherokees find this frustrating because what they see is arrogant British who expect them to obey their commands. Cherokees don't take commands from the British. Right? The way to get Cherokees to do what you want is to give gifts, because that shows that you are committed to this alliance with them, and that reinforces the agreement. To Washington and fellow officers, this seems like you can't get Cherokees to do anything without paying them. Right? And so even though they are allies fighting in a common cause, or at least fighting parallel wars, this cultural gulf that exists between them is highlighted, and it generates problems that will actually lead to conflict between the British and the Cherokees in the so-called Cherokee War in 1759-60-61. But even the French, who were famous for their ability to cultivate and maintain Indian alliances, very often French officers complained about their Indian allies because they fought wars differently. They marched to their own tune, as it were, but they also recognized how dependent they were on Indian allies. As one French officer said, We cannot do without Indians in this country any more than an army could do without cavalry. And Europeans often resented that dependence, and I think some of that is apparent in Washington's reactions too.
So let's discuss a little bit of the years leading up to the Revolutionary War, the American Revolution, as well as the war itself. Beginning in 1771, for example, John Murray, the Earl of Dunmore, instead of enforcing the Crown's restrictions on Western settlement, which refers to the 1763 proclamation, etc., Dunmore befriended men like Thomas Walker and our George Washington, who claimed and coveted tens of thousands of acres beyond the Appalachians and were willing to share part of their claims in appreciation. How and why did this friendship result in Dunmore's 1775 plans to annul the land patents Washington had received, a decision that would strip Washington of 23,000 acres? And what was Washington's reaction to that?
Yeah, I think these years, the dozen or so years before the American Revolution, are crucial to understand, obviously crucial to understanding the American Revolution. But again, I think there's an important Native American component or thread that needs to go in there. So at the end of the Seven Years' War, the British are victorious, the French are kicked out, the British have promised the Indians that if they abandoned the French and did not resist British invasion into their lands, that their lands would be secure. At the end of that war, the British forget those pledges. They put garrisons in Indian country, broke at the end of the most expensive war the British fought. They cut back on supplies and gifts to Indians. So given what I was talking about in just moments earlier, if giving gifts is a symbol and a sign of friendship and alliance, withholding gifts, cutting off trade, cutting down sales of ammunition is a gesture of hostility, particularly at a time when redcoat garrisons are taking over French forts. It produces a so-called Indian Rebellion. I prefer to call it the First American War of Indian Independence. It's often called Pontiac's War, where Indian peoples in the Ohio Valley and Great Lakes take on the British Empire and basically knock it back on its heels. To avoid that happening again, the British do a couple of things. First of all, they say, well, we're going to have to keep an army in North America. Keeping 10,000 British soldiers in North America is an expensive proposition. Britain is broke. How are you going to pay for it? Some bright spark has the bright idea of, well, let's tax the colonists to do that and to help administer this empire. And we all know how that played out, because that's a fundamental part of the standard interpretation of the origins of the American Revolution. The other thing that they do, and this is a piece that's not given so much attention, in 1763, the British say, we've got to avoid these recurrent frontier conflicts. And the way to do that is to regulate the frontier and stop British people, white people, if you like, trespassing on the Indian lands. So in 1763, the British government issues a proclamation. It's called the Royal Proclamation. George III signs it, which essentially says, east of the Appalachian Mountains, that's British territory. West of the Appalachian Mountains, that's British territory too, but it's an Indian reserve. And people don't go there without proper authority, and nobody buys land there except the Crown. To cut down individuals, land companies, etc., cheating Indians out of their land. Fair enough, that seems like a good idea. The problem is, that people like George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, the Lee family in Virginia, most of the elite families of Virginia and other colonies, have for years been speculating in Western land. You get hold of land beyond the Appalachians, you get a claim to it in anticipation that once the French are defeated, then the West will be open to settlement. Colonists will swarm across the Appalachian Mountains, eager to buy or rent land, and you will just make a killing. The French are defeated. The way west is open, and then the British slam the door. And that's incredibly frustrating for people like Washington, who've been waiting for this day. Immediately, they are lobbying to get the proclamation line moved. Washington basically conspires with his land agent, says, well, let's just ignore it. It's going to fall away. So in a sense, they continue to speculate and invest in Indian land. When Governor Dunmore, John Murray, Earl of Dunmore, arrives, these are his people, right? And so he immediately comes on board with what they're doing and in anticipation of getting land. And in fact, many historians hold him responsible for fomenting a war with the Shawnees. It's called Dunmore's War, in which he defeats the Shawnees, or the Virginians defeat the Shawnees, and acquire a huge amount of land as a result of that. But Britain is tightening its restraints, and the government determines that the claims of people like George Washington to Indian land under an earlier proclamation by the governor of Virginia in 1754 and under the Royal Proclamation, which actually allotted land bounties to regular officers in the British Army. The government now says this doesn't apply. The earlier proclamation didn't apply to officers like Washington. It applied to rank and file soldiers. And the 1763 proclamation did not apply to colonial militia, only to regular officers. And as the government, this is a time, of course, when the British government is tightening its control over the colony. When it comes to that point, Governor Dunmore has to decide which way is he going to go. And he sides with the British government. So he then is the person who's, I mean, in some ways, he's the messenger who says this is not going to happen. And that means that, as in the quotation that you read, that Washington stands to be out 23,000 acres. And I'm not the first person to have pointed out that it's this that really alienates Washington from the British Empire, which he had fought for and served in the Seven Years' War. Now it seems that the British Empire has replaced the French Empire as the obstacle to him being able to realize his Western land ambitions. And so now he seriously considers separation from that empire. So the War of Independence is a war of independence, but part of that independence is the freedom to speculate in and make money from Indian land. The War of Independence is also a war about Indian land and who has access to Indian land, which means that for Indian people, it's what the American Revolution is also a war about land, their land, and it's also for them a war of independence, their independence from Americans who seem intent on acquiring that land at all costs.
In contrast to the British and Indian tax on American settlements that Washington denounced during the Revolutionary War, how did he conceive of Sullivan's campaign, which you alluded to earlier, Sullivan's campaign, during the war, including the rape and murder of a female native elder in the French Catherine's Town?
So when the revolution breaks out, Indian people face difficult choices. Most of them, for as long as they can, want to remain neutral. They regard this as, if you like, a domestic fight between Englishmen. But neutrality for Indian people is rarely an option. They're going to get caught up on it because contending parties regard them as hostile, if not allied. Most finish up siding with the British, who have at least demonstrated some attempt to protect their land, and against the Americans, who seem hell-bent on getting their land. And the majority of the Iroquois Confederacy, not all, side with the British, launch attacks on the American frontier. And this is brutal guerrilla warfare. It's the kind of warfare that Thomas Jefferson refers to in the Declaration of Independence, and that's how it's always characterized. And Washington, to stem those attacks, dispatches American armies into Iroquois country and appoints General John Sullivan to lead this expedition. And what he adopts is not a new strategy, it's standard strategy. Colonial powers fighting Indian people in the eastern woodlands achieved success not by marching armies into Indian country and meeting Indians in open battle, as Braddock's defeat demonstrated. They achieved success by marching into Indian country and targeting Indian villages and Indian cornfields. The French did this. The British did this in the Cherokee War. Washington does this in the Revolution. You send your armies into Indian country, find the villages, destroy the villages, find the cornfields and the crops and the orchards and destroy those. It's total warfare visited in Indian country. And the idea is this will not only stem the attacks at source, but also essentially bring scorched earth policy to Iroquois country. Sullivan's campaign is Washington's campaign. He conceives it, he plans it, he's meticulous in his attention to detail, and he devotes a large part of the Continental Army to carrying this out. And it makes it quite clear to Sullivan, nothing less than the total destruction of Iroquois country is acceptable. Don't talk peace with them until you've destroyed their towns and villages. And Sullivan does as he's ordered. He comes back and reports that he's destroyed 40 Iroquois towns and 160,000 bushels of corn. The armies spend days in Indian towns destroying cornfields, destroying stores of corn, cutting down orchards, etc. Sullivan's officers recognize that this is a historic event, and a lot of them keep journals and accounts of that. And they record this cornucopia that they're seeing, which means that this country becomes very desirable after the American Revolution to American settlers. But they also, some of them, acknowledge instances of brutality and atrocity. One of which is that they found a native woman, an elder native woman, who they allow to live. Right? They don't kill her. But the officer also mentions that there was a younger woman with her, and that when the army's returning back at the end of the expedition and they go through the village, they find the naked body of this young woman, who the implication is clearly had been raped and killed. And of course, this was something that Washington had no expectation or vision of. Washington was about, he wanted to destroy Iroquois towns and Iroquois crops, and destroy their ability to wage war and to create a refugee problem for the British, which they did, because Iroquois people fleeing their homes went to the British at Fort Niagara, and between 3,000 and 5,000 native people were huddled around Fort Niagara in the winter of 1779, which is one of the coldest winters on record.
So it was the younger woman that was actually killed.
It was the younger woman that was actually killed. And, of course, you could say, what would you expect? Because this kind of warfare actually targets the female domain. Right? In Eastern woodland societies, men kind of operate outside the village. They do the hunting, they do the warfare, they conduct the diplomacy. That tends to go on outside, and in that sense, to put it simply, men take life. Women give life and cultivate. They give birth, they plant the crops, they raise the crops. So when you are sending armies to target Indian villages and cornfields, that's the domain of women. And the intention may not be to inflict casualties and for this kind of thing to happen, but the chances are that it will.
So the following is a two-part question about the Revolutionary War. First, how and why did the story of the capture and torture of William Crawford, Washington's friend, help to imprint Thomas Jefferson's reference to merciless savages in the national memory for years to come? And then second, can you elaborate on your argument that, while Washington decried the violence against Native peoples, he knew that military strikes against the Indians were necessary to establish a claim to the Western lands he had long coveted for himself and now coveted for the new nation?
Yeah, so to start with William Crawford. William Crawford was a business associate of Washington. When Washington wrote to someone and said, let's ignore the 1763 proclamation, it's William Crawford. He says, see if you can get me some land surreptitiously so that when this proclamation line fails or is removed, we'll be in possession of the lands that are the cream of the country. So this is Washington's friend and business associate. He is he leads an expedition into northwestern Ohio in Indian country during the Revolution. His force is attacked and defeated, routed. A number of people are taken captive and marked for death, marked for torture. One of those is William Crawford, and the torture that he endures is grisly and horrible, and it's reported by a couple of captives who escape, make it back to the American settlements. And it makes its way into the literature of the Revolution and Indian Wars. And basically, it reaffirms what Jefferson had said in the American Declaration of Independence. Indian warriors are savages. They commit these atrocities. It becomes used with that account by Jefferson as justification for dispelling and dispossessing Indians after the Revolution. Where will Indians be in the new American Republic? What will their place be? Well, they should have no place, because while the Americans were fighting for freedom at the moment of their birth, Indians were not only fighting for the king, but doing this horrible kind of stuff. Right? They were savages. The broader context for this is that the Delawares had tried to remain neutral for as much of the Revolution as they could. Some Delawares actually refused to go to war, even though most Delawares tended to gravitate toward the British eventually. Delawares who had converted to the Moravian faith and lived in their own villages were Christians and they were pacifists, so they could have no part of the war. And what had happened was that a force of Pennsylvania militia going into Indian country to retaliate for Delaware raids basically took their vengeance instead on a village of Christian Delaware pacifists at a place called Nardenhut, and it means tents of grace. They rounded up the Indians, divided them into three groups, men, women, and children, and then essentially bludgeoned to death with wooden mallets 96 men, women, and children. That obviously had huge repercussions in Indian country, as George Washington knew it would. He sent instructions to his commanders in the West saying, basically, tell your soldiers not to allow themselves to be taken captive, because they will be subject to this horrendous retaliation for this. So he knew what was going to happen. William Crawford was not at the Nardenhut massacre, but he then proceeds to lead another expedition into Indian country, which encounters not pacifist Christian Indians, but resistant Indians who defeat him and torture him. This is brutal and graphically described, but it's culturally required. Those Delaware warriors who carried out that torture did so. It was imperative that they did so. They were required to avenge their clan relatives who died at American hands. The victim of their vengeance does not have to be the actual perpetrator of the original crime. Right? So even though this torture was brutal in its elements, it was not thoughtless. It was ritually carried out, in which one of the Delaware chiefs, a guy by the name of Hopakan or Captain Pipe, who actually 4 or 5 years later had signed the Treaty of Fort Pitt with the Americans, with William Crawford present, so these guys knew each other, delivered a speech explaining what was going on. So Indian people actually tell the British at the end of the American Revolution, the Americans tell lies about us in their newspapers. And we don't have newspapers. But if we did and could give our account of the atrocities and brutalities that had been visited upon us, people would have a very different opinion about which of us were was the Christian part, which of us were the Christians. Those events take place in the early 1780s, 1781, 1782. The war in the West continues long after General Cornwallis has surrendered at Yorktown, which essentially secures American independence. And one of the reasons for that is that the Americans need to establish a claim to Western land. We're used to looking at textbooks that simply show the United States as it existed after independence, right? That at the Treaty of Paris in 1783, the British recognize independent American independence and hand over all the territory south of Canada and the Great Lakes, east of the Mississippi and north of Florida. It was not always guaranteed that that was going to happen. Because remember, the British had established a barrier at the Appalachian Mountains. In 1774, the British extended the boundaries of Quebec southwards to the Ohio River and put that disputed Ohio country as part of the province of Quebec. There were movements among European powers during the Revolution to negotiate a peace, and basically they argued that the peace would entail American independence, and the territorial boundaries would be decided by who was in possession of what territory at the time. Right? The Americans, and George Washington knew this, needed to establish claims to Western land. Right? They needed to be able to have a justifiable claim to Iroquois country, to the rich Ohio country. If you didn't have that, then a lot of those land claims would be lost. But also Washington recognized that an independent new nation, a collection of states hemmed in east of the Appalachian Mountains, would be stifled. It needed to be able to grow, and if it was going to grow, it was going to grow to the west, onto Western land. And at the end of the war, of course, that was really the only resource that the United States had. Washington knew that, and he, in that sense, already had a vision for how things must happen after independence.
In the early Republic period, you hold that for Secretary of War Henry Knox and the first federal president, George Washington, saving Indian people from destruction meant transforming Indian lives. Washington recommended what he termed rational experiments for imparting the blessings of civilization and believed, or at least hoped, that the United States would not need to fight Indians if it traded with them. The twin instruments for carrying out this policy were Indian agents and government trading posts. What were these rational experiments in social engineering? What were the role of agents and trading posts? In addition, how did Scottish Enlightenment views inform Washington's views, from intensive agriculture to prescribed gender roles?
Yes. So an early review of this book, it's actually in the New York Review of Books, says, you know, Calloway seems kind of ambivalent about Washington. You bet. I'm deeply ambivalent about him, and it's wrapped up in his Indian policy. Because Washington is not just a sort of bêtoir for American imperialism and expansion and Indian killing. But as first president, he has the opportunity and the responsibility to establish an Indian policy for the new nation. Well, there are certain givens. And the first given is that the United States will take Indian land. This is not just Washington talking. This is laid out in the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which is a blueprint for how the United States will grow. First by establishing territories, then by those territories becoming states. But that expansion will be accompanied by just dealings with Indians. There's a challenge, right? So number one priority is acquiring land, but do it if possible. And Washington and Knox spend a lot of time and energy and ink on this question by dealing honorably with Indian people, because we want the new nation to look good at to the rest of the world. And we also, this is who we are. We need to establish ourselves as a nation of justice. How do you do that? Well, if you're going to get Indian land, you do it by offering Indians a fair price, doing what the British had done and make treaties with Indians so that this can be done, this transfer of Indian land can be done properly. The problem is, what if the Indians refuse? Then, given your priority, which is non-negotiable, you have to have their land, then, well, you have to go to war for them. Or as Washington said, the term he used was to extirpate them, to root them out or completely destroy them. And so those are the two elements of Washington's Indian policy and of American Indian policy. It's a contradiction, and it's one that perhaps is never reconciled. Was there an alternative? Well, yes, there was. You could civilize Indian people. Now, Scottish Enlightenment thinking, which was prevalent in the colonies at the time, you know, Jefferson was tutored by a Scottish teacher, etc., held that humanity, peoples existed on different scales and at different stages. But these stages reflected human development. People were not frozen at one stage because of their race. These are later ideas that come into American thinking. If Indian people are backward, inferior, and primitive, as they are, people argue at the time, it's because they haven't yet had the opportunities that English people or Americans have had. But given those opportunities, Christianity, education, if you like, civilization, they can be raised up. So, to do justice to Indian people, you can do that justice by giving them civilization, by helping them to move up this scale of human development. The good thing about that is that for early 19th century Americans, civilization fundamentally means agriculture, right? Sedentary societies practicing agriculture. Hunting societies are savage, backward, primitive. So in order for Indians to become civilized, they must stop hunting and become farmers. That means they need a lot less land, because instead of ranging over hundreds of square miles hunting, they can now derive a living from the soil by practicing American-style plow agriculture. So they've now got lots of land they don't need, and that land is also becoming less valuable to them because the encroachment of American settlers is diminishing the game. So this works for everybody. Now the question, of course, is, well, wait a minute. When Sullivan's army went through Iroquois country, it spent all that time burning Iroquois cornfields. The British burnt Cherokee cornfields. These people, of course, were already practicing agriculture. The problem from the American perspective is that the wrong people are growing the crops. Indian women grew the crops. For American civilization to take hold, Indian men have to become the farmers. And so Washington's program of civilization is a program that he seems as a program of salvation. This will save Indian people, because unless they give up their hunting way of life and become farmers, they're doomed to extinction. And we need to promote this. And you do that by sending agents to Indian country, to Indian communities, to try and instill these changes, and also by establishing government trading posts where Indian people will come and get the things that they need to help advance this new program. Interestingly, in 1790, Congress passes in Washington support a thing called the Indian Trade and Intercourse Act.
Yes.
Which says nobody trades in Indian country without a license, government license, and it's illegal to buy and sell Indian land without congressional approval. In many ways, this is like a mirror, a carbon copy of what the Royal Proclamation of 1763 had said, which Washington had been furious about and railed about. Now he and his government are doing much the same thing, because they find themselves confronted with much the same problems that the British had in 1763. How do you do this? How do you know that white settlement is going to increase and expand onto Indian land? You need to try and regulate and restrain that to avoid recurrent Native American warfares. And you also try to do the right thing in dealing with Indian people. And of course, people like Washington and Knox and Jefferson had very clear ideas about what was right for Indian people. Indian people did not always share that view.
How do you reconcile, on that note, the dual contentions that Washington's civilization program constituted genocide by another name, yet Washington also saw his policies as setting Indians on the road to survival? How and why did, for example, some Senecas hold Washington in his memory and reverence?
Yeah, this is interesting, because it is, as I said, the contradiction of United States Indian policy, not just in Washington's time, but for generations to come. Right? For Indians to survive, they must become civilized, and so they must change forever. They must, in short, become like Americans, not just farm like Americans, but they need to live like Americans, act like Americans, hopefully think like Americans. In other words, stop being Indians. Right? And this idea that the cost of Indian survival is the destruction of Indian culture pervades 19th century American Indian policy. It's the genesis of that phrase attributed to Richard Henry Pratt and the boarding school era, kill the Indian and save the man. For the man, for the person to survive, the Indian must die. There are various definitions of genocide, some very narrow, some very broad. But one includes the destruction or attempts to destroy culture. Right? And I would not say that Washington deliberately had this intention, but this is going to be the cost to Indian people of survival on Washington's terms. And because ultimately, Indians who survive will survive not as members of tribes, because there's no place for Indian tribes in a communal way of life and communal landholding in the United States, but they will survive as individuals, hopefully living much like Americans live. And they will be people of Indian descent, but they won't be members of Indian tribes. So given all of that, and given Sullivan's campaign into Iroquois country, which particularly targeted the Senecas, there's this interesting event that happens the year that Washington dies. A Seneca by the name of Handsome Lake has a vision, which he says he goes to heaven, right? And he comes back with a message of revival for his people. And he says, the Indian heaven is a place where there are no white men allowed, right? Except George Washington, whom he saw sitting outside, right? And other Senecas talk about reverence for George Washington. And John Ross, a Cherokee chief, principal chief of the Cherokees at the time of removal, names one of his sons George Washington. So there's lots of instances in which Indian people, toward the end of Washington's life, and then especially after he dies, invoke Washington and Washington's presidency as almost like a golden era for them. So if I'm ambivalent about Washington, so are Indian people in and shortly after his own lifetime. Right? And part of it is they are consciously invoking the image and the memory of the first president and saying he was somebody who tried, even if he didn't succeed, who tried to give us justice. Maybe the United States should follow that example. But often they, certainly in the case of John Ross, they are looking back at Washington's administration and these formative years of Indian policy from the context of a very different era. In 1830, Congress passes the Indian Removal Act. Andrew Jackson is president. And that question that Washington and Knox struggled with, what would be the place of Indians, Indian people, in this new republic, this new nation that we're building, was answered. There will be no place. Indians will be removed. They'll be relocated west of the Mississippi. From that perspective and that environment, it made sense, I think, for a Cherokee chief like John Ross, who had seen his people follow Washington's civilization program as a recipe for survival, to revere this president. Washington had at least tried to reconcile those apparently irreconcilable elements of Indian policy. Expansion, meaning taking Indian land, and justice to Indians. And of course, Washington failed, but America has failed. That's the contradictions and the dilemmas that were at work here.
Thank you, Professor Calloway. I have one final question. What can we expect from you next that you can disclose? Vacation, or are you working on another project, or anything that you would like to comment on?
Yeah, I'm not very good at vacation, and I suspect I wouldn't be any good in retirement. So I have a couple of things in mind. One thing that I'm intrigued in, and I'm working on, I'm beginning to gather steam on, and is the experiences of Indian people in early American cities. People have written a lot about Indian delegations visiting Washington, the city Washington, after 1800. And I write in this book a lot about Indian people who visit Philadelphia to see the first president and have negotiations, etc. What struck me in doing this was going back to our original question about corn planter. Right? When corn planter and a Seneca delegation come to Philadelphia to visit Washington, they have an exchange of speeches back and forth. These are prepared, kind of written talks that goes on a couple of months at least. So they're in Philadelphia for a couple of months and they're actually talking, doing business, if you like, for a couple of days. What are they doing the rest of the time? And so I'm in the beginning phases of a book to explore that. Because that's when the Indians are very often, if you like, off record, because the official records don't account for what they're doing. And so I'm hunting through newspapers and things of that nature to see what they were doing and what they made of it all. When you come to a city like Philadelphia, what they do? Well, one of the things we know is that they went to the circus and they went to the theater. And we know that because newspapers would advertise that. They might advertise that there was a circus that night or a play at the theater that night, but not so much. But what they do advertise is they let their readers know that the Indian delegations who are in the city are going to go to the circus tonight or will attend the theater that night, because that is regarded as something that the citizens of Philadelphia would want to turn out and see. So it's those kinds of of issues that I want to get at. And I'm thinking, I'm looking at this as this would be the Indians' urban frontier, right? So instead of white Americans going west and touching an Indian world, which becomes their Indian frontier, these are native people traveling east and touching the, if you like, the western edges of an Atlantic frontier, and this is their frontier, whether they're meeting white people in churches or taverns or in the red light district of Philadelphia, they're encountering this new world. So that's kind of what I'm thinking of right now.
Sounds compelling. If you hope you think of us next time. So this is Ryan Tripp. We've been talking to and discussing Professor Calloway's Indian World of George Washington. Thank you, listener, for again joining us. We'll hear you and see you next time on the New Books Network Native American Studies channel. Thank you.
Thank you very much.